Portion. I just a couple of announcements. First of all, we hope you are enjoying it. I know many of you are. I know I am, and we thank you for being here. And I haven't been outside for a few hours, but I understand the snow is continuing. So even if you want to leave, you can't. So you're all stuck here. And we hope to see you next Thursday, December 25th. You may have heard of the day. I don't think anybody is working. So if you want to join us, we're having another one of the seminars on Jews, Christians. This is a local speaker program, but it promises to be an excellent program, so everybody's invited. We have tapes available. If anybody would like tapes, it'll probably take us a week to 10 days. Let's say, hopefully by next Thursday, if we're lucky, we can have them. The tapes of this program, you can order them now if you'd like. There are evaluation forms. And that's just in terms of the announcements. Also, I really want to thank our partners, really, and who helped to put this all together. You know, you cannot do this. This is not a one-man show or it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of people. I want to thank Elliot Malamud, who is my partner with – we'll come to one in a second. I want to thank Elliot for all his hard work and ideas, and we've been at this for a few years, and it's a good partnership, and I want to thank him. He doesn't always get the credit that is due to him, and of course Ilana, who often doesn't get the credit that is due to her. Okay, enough, and we want to thank her. It's the our tripod with one piece is missing. We're in trouble, and want to thank all you who, if without your attendance, these programs wouldn't be meaningful. So thank you very much. So I'm going to introduce Elliot to introduce his friend to start the second half of the program. Thank you.
It's really, for me, a privilege and a delight to introduce to you my good friend of many years, Rabbi Menachem Mendelowitz. Rabbi Mendelowitz was born in Muncie, New York, to Rabbi Shmuel Mendelowitz, who was the son of Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz, about whom Menachem will be speaking today. He has made Aliyah 5.5 years ago to Eretz Yisrael and currently lives on Moshav Yishi, where he is the Rav of the Moshav. Prior to that, he had been involved in Rabbanut in New York, and he was the Rav in Hicksville in Long Island in Congre Shari Tzedek. And he holds an M.Ed. from Providence College, as well as a B.A. from Adelphi, and currently is commuting in rather tiring but ultimately useful fashion between Eretz Yisrael and New York, where he also works in real estate. So he is a person who exemplifies Torah in Derech Eretz. Menachem and I have been talking for some time, a few years, about giving a talk about his grandfather and the complexity of portraying great rabbinic figures, the difficulty in doing that with honesty and sensitivity. So it is to that he is going to turn his attention today, and we welcome him.
Thank you very much, Elliot. I need to start with one correction. I am not the, even though Elliot's my friend, he'd like to make me sound more important than I really am. I'm not the rabbi of Moshav Yishi, but rather we began an Ashkenazi minyan shul on a Temani Moshav. And I don't know if Dr. Lyman is still here, but we use a Temani Sefer Torah in the Ashkenazi minyan, because there's a halacha. When in Rome, do as the Romans. And we therefore have actually incorporated a lot of the Temani minhagim in our shul. So I am just the unofficial rav of this innovative Ashkenazi minyan on Moshav Yishi, which is a Temani Moshav outside Beit Shemesh. Thank you, Rabbi and Mrs. Kelman. Thank you, Elliot and Leah. That's really my connection to Elliot. for the opportunity to participate in an eye-opening day. And what an honor and a privilege to be here at the podium and share the podium with the likes of Dr. Shapiro and Dr. Schneelerman. And just take a moment to recognize my wife Dina's parents, Albert and Ruth Edelstein, who are here with us in the audience. And I thank you for the support you lend on every occasion. Greetings from Israel, the one place on earth, the only place on earth, that Jews can realize their divinely ordained potential. Where Jews can live to the fullest, where all the commandments of the Torah are relevant. As the Ramban, Nachmanides, says in no less than three places in his commentary on the Torah, it is the only place on earth where the mitzvot, the Torah commandments, are at all relevant. According to the Ramban, according to Nachmanides, Torah observance outside the biblical boundaries of Israel can be best compared to spring training. It's important, but it doesn't really count. And I begin with salutations from Israel for three reasons. Firstly, I arrived but 5 hours ago from Israel, where I said I live with my family on a little moshav called Moshav Yishi. And we sit, and we wait, and we set the table, socially, economically, politically, and religiously, for our brethren, the nation of Jews, to come and help in the difficult task and the holy task of bringing the day of redemption, when all of mankind will unite by Yomahu Yiyeh Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad and recognize God's sovereignty over all of the world. Secondly, insofar that we are here today to discuss the accuracy of recorded history, as Jews living in the diaspora, I think it's imperative that you take into your hearts and live with the awareness every moment of every day that from a historical perspective, life in the diaspora, we know, is but transient. And this is one phenomenon reoccurring in Jewish history that has certainly been recorded accurately. That truth is for everyone. Regardless of how comfortable we may be, regardless of our social and economic successes, regardless of our religious successes, as students of Jewish history, we must be honest with ourselves, know and recognize our history. And although I know my message is somewhat trite, it is a message that must be delivered over and over again. And lest you become complacent, come visit Israel and speak to the latest wave of Olim from Argentina, from South Africa, and from France. Would you believe that we again are living in 1938, with the chief rabbi of France 2 weeks ago gave a psak halacha that men should walk in the streets without a kippah? Such is the case of Judaism in Europe today. God blessed us with the state of Israel. Reishit tzmichat geulateinu, the beginning of the long-awaited redemption. Rav Noach Weinberg, I believe he's a brother to Rav Yaakov Weinberg, who has been mentioned a number of times, is fond of saying, God is always talking to us. Our problem is, we're not listening. In 1948, God said, here's a gift. You've been praying for 2,000 years. Here it is. It's not going to be easy. Good things never do come easy. But if the Jewish nation wills it, then the Jewish nation can bring an end to our wandering with a determination to be unequivocal about our sovereignty in our land. Finally, I begin with salutations from Israel because despite the fact that my grandfather, Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, who is the topic of my talk today, devoted his life to Torah education in the Western Hemisphere, his mind and his heart were constantly on Eretz Yisrael. As the great Jewish philosopher Rav Yehuda Halevi said about his existence in Spain, I am in the West, but my heart is in the East. The complexity of greatness, my grandfather, Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendelovich. Many of you prior to today likely have never heard of my grandfather. Who was he? What did he accomplish? And what effect did he have on Jewish life in America? On the other hand, certainly after this morning, I know you've all heard of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And I'm not sure if this quite fits, but it's in my script, so we'll continue with it. Rav Moshe Feinstein, whose responsa are the basis for modern-day halacha. So allow me to tell you who my grandfather was in the words of Rav Moshe Feinstein. We know at each juncture of Jewish history, there's always been a personality that has shaped the next unique link in what has been the longest chain in the history of a people and a religion. 2,000 years ago, towards the end of the Second Commonwealth, that person was Yehoshua ben Gamla. The Gemara tells us, Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, concerning Yehoshua ben Gamla, and the Aramaic reads as follows, Biram, Zachor ato ish latov, Yehoshua ben Gamla shemo, She'il malei hu, Ishtakach Torah miYisrael. Remember that man for good, and Yehoshua ben Gamla is his name. For if not for him, Torah would have been forgotten from Israel. Paraphrasing these words of Rav, Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote in a letter the following, Ki tzrichim anachnu kulanu lomar alav, ki ha de'amar Rav Yehuda amarav al Yehoshua ben Gamla, zachor harav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich latov, she'ilmalei hu lohaya inyan limud ha-Torah v'inyan yirat shamayim v'bidinotenu de'amerika. Rav Moshe said, it is incumbent upon all of us to declare about him, as Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, regarding Yehoshua ben Gamla. Remember Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendelovich for good. For if not for him, there would be no concept of Torah scholarship or the concept of Yirat Shemayim, the fear of heaven, in this country of ours, America. Yehoshua ben Gamla was the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, just prior to the destruction of the Second Temple. He is credited with establishing the educational system and the institutions which were to frame Jewish survival in the diaspora. Rav Moshe implies, just as Yehoshua ben Gamla is credited and his work guaranteed the survival of Torah after the destruction of the temple, so too the work of my grandfather, to some extent, guaranteed the survival of Torah following the great destruction of the 1930s and 40s. Given Rav Moshe's words, I would trust that you are in agreement that my grandfather's life and his work are worthy of investigation. I would like to begin with a synopsis of his life. Who was this man? What was his greatness? And where is the complexity? I ask you to please pay close attention for 90 seconds as I attempt to give you a most brief overview of the early part of his life. And most of the following will be a direct quote from one of the three biographies he wrote or from some of the articles written about him. And as his grandchild growing up, what you're about to hear is very typical of the stories I would hear about my Zayde. I'm going to read, and pardon me as I read directly from the text, on a day like today with such a discriminating audience, I want to make sure that what I say is accurate. So 90 seconds, here we go. My grandfather, Reb Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, was born in 1886 to a Hasidic family in the shtetl of Vilag, which is in the modern-day Hungary near the border of Czechoslovakia. His father, Reb Moshe Mendelovich, owned a tannery and is believed to have lived relatively a comfortable life. As a young boy, Shraga was a source of great concern to his parents because he did not utter a single word until he was five. At that age, his mother's tears and prayers were finally answered, and soon he began to talk. As soon as he was able to speak, his father took him to the local melamed to learn the Aleph Beis. It was soon clear that Shraga Feivel was blessed not only with a quick grasp, but an unusually sensitive soul. As he herded the family geese through the unpaved streets of Vilag, he would recite Kapitlach Tehillim by heart. At the age of 10, his mother tragically died in a fire, and his father took a second wife named Toba and moved the family from Vilag to Humana. Shraga Feivel was particularly fortunate as Toba showered her husband's young children with love and raised them as if they were her own. At the age of 12, having already mastered many tractates in the Talmud, the local Melamed in Humana pronounced himself unable to teach him anything else, at which point he embarked on a sojourn through the Batei Midrash of the great Talmudic scholars of the Hungarian Hasidic community. First with Rav Aaron, the Dayan of Mezolabritz, then Rav Moshe Greenwald, the author of Arugas HaBosem, who asked Shraga Feivel at the age of 16 to review the manuscript of Arugas HaBosem before it went to print, and actually asked him to edit the section on Masechet Mikvaot, which is perhaps one of the most difficult sections of Jewish law. At the age of 17, he went to Unsdorf and studied with Rabbi Shmuel Rosenberg, author of the Response to Be'er Shmuel, the preeminent postek in the Hungarian community at the time, and from which he received smicha. Rabbi Rosenberg had the most profound and lasting effect on my grandfather. It is claimed that Rabbi Rosenberg appeared to him posthumously a number of times. Elliot, I'm doing this with a straight face. At the age of 19, he continued his studies in Pressburg under the guidance of Rav Simcha Bunim Schreiber, the grandson of the famous Chatam Sofer. And by this time, he was not only a bucky in all of the Talmud, all of Shas, meaning proficient in all of Shas, and ordained in all sections of Halacha. He was expert in Tanakh and all the traditional commentaries, works of Machshava, philosophy, Musar, ethical literature, Chassidut, and Jewish history. He married in Europe, we believe, in 1910. His wedding is noteworthy insofar that he refused to don a strimal at his wedding, which was customary. Two of his seven children were born in Europe before God willed it that he should leave to America and boarded a boat in 1913. Okay, I may have gone a little bit over my 90 seconds, but that's a synopsis of my grandfather's life in Europe, the story I heard as a child, and the story recorded by the biographies written on him. I have a problem with that story. Aside the fact that this storyline could possibly be told about many such young men growing up in Hungary, where do we see here what motivated a young man to do things out of the ordinary? What motivated a Hasidic boy from Vilag, who heard the family geese reciting Kapitloch Tehillim, whose father was a tanner, to spend his teenage years becoming a brilliant scholar? What motivated a Hasidic boy from Vilag, who recited Kapitloch Tehillim, herding the family geese to the unpaved streets of Vilag, whose father was a tanner, to become expert in subjects that were totally foreign to anything studied in all the shtetlach of Europe? More importantly, what motivated this Hasidic boy from Vilag, who recited Kapitloch Tehillim, whose father was a tanner, to leave the comforts of his familial shtetl, to leave his religious shtetl, to leave his Hasidic shtetl, and board a boat in 1913, leaving his wife and two children behind for what would end up being 7 years, and travel to a modern country, unfamiliar territory, where there were very few Jews, certainly fewer religious Jews, and virtually no Hasidic Jews. And now I'll get a little ahead of myself and ask, what motivated a Hasidic boy from Vilag, who recited Kapitloch Tehillim by heart, herding the family geese through the streets of Vilag, whose father was a tanner, to come to America and establish an educational system that exists with us today? A yeshiva system and a day school system. And a goal to have a day school, we're talking 1913, he got on a boat, with a goal to have a day school in every community in the U.S. and Canada that had a Jewish population. There's something missing in the story that's never been told, not to me, and it's not in the book. And with your indulgence, I'd like to start the story all over again, my version. My grandfather, Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, was born in 1886 to a Hasidic family in a shtetl named Vilag, which is in modern-day Hungary, near the border with Czechoslovakia. His father, Moshe Mendelovich, owned a tannery and is believed to have lived a relatively comfortable life. And this is where we part. Shraga Feivel was clearly not an average child. His speech development lagged behind the average child. He began talking first at the age of 5 and was kept close to home. Among other chores, he was known to herd the family geese through the unpaved streets of Vilag, reciting Kapitloch Tehillim by heart. But he had no formal education, other than being tutored by a local Melamed. As a result of his special needs early in life, and the inordinate amount of time spent at home, it would be fair to assume that he developed an unusually close bond with his mother. Along with her prayers and tears, must have come lots of hugs. One can only imagine the devastation when at the vulnerable age of 10, He lost everything. On Yom Kippur Eve in 1896, a fire gutted the Mendelwitz house in Vilag. And young Shraga Feivel watched helplessly as his entire world came to a sudden end. His mother and all but one sibling perished on that Yom Kippur night. Can you imagine the trauma of a 10-year-old boy escaping the inferno of his home on fire to watch with his father and a younger sister as his entire life, everything he loved, everything that was familiar to him, his mother, his siblings, his home, his security, perished. And he watched helplessly. His father remarried almost immediately and moved young Shraga Feivel from the familiar shtetl of Vilag to a new and unfamiliar shtetl of Humene. The dynamics had all changed. A new family, a stepmother, a new home, a new town. And this seemed to prove a bit too much. And so Shraga Feivel was sent away. Yet before his bar mitzvah, he left home to study in the Batei Midrash of great Hungarian scholars. We can imagine that during these teenage years, he must have felt very alone. He was nicknamed, in the Batei Midrash, he was nicknamed the Matzmid, properly pronounced, or in modern Hebrew pronounced Matzmid, which you can be a frequent flyer in El Al like I am, or you can be a studious individual. And besides its literal meaning, it perhaps connotes a loner, a euphemism for a loner, Matzmid, someone who's always sitting in shul, learning, never socializing, nothing to his life other than his book and himself and his thoughts. And understandably, he felt very alone. At this point, he's 12 years old. Not only is he away from home, he even had no home to dream of, no home to comfort him, and no mother to console him. Only the memory, the vision of the fire, and his mother and siblings trapped inside. To cope with this loneliness and extreme pain, he followed the Talmudic dictum, Chash b'chol gufo yasok b'torah. Someone whose entire being is in pain, he should engross himself in the study of Torah. And to comfort that soul, that pained soul, he spent the next 8 years of his life totally engrossed in study. And he would let nothing get in the way of this passion. Not the Hasidic limitations of his shtetl, not the social mores of the Hasidic community, and not the rigid curriculum of Hungarian yeshivot. He turned out to be anything but the conventional yeshiva bachur. Besides his primary study and proficiency that he acquired in Talmud, the entire Babylonian Talmud, and the entire Jerusalem Talmud, he found time to become expert in halacha, both the Tur Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam's Yad. He became totally literate in all of Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, prophets, and the writings. He was fully knowledgeable of the writing of Josephus and the other Apocrypha. or I should say, and the Apocrypha. He studied philosophy, particularly the writings of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and Maimonides. He studied Chassidut and Kabbalah, in particular the writings of Rabbi Tzadok of Lublin, the Baal HaTanya, and the works of the Ramchal. And despite studying under the tutelage of the great Hungarian Talmudic scholars, among other interests, he clandestinely became proficient in the German language to enable him to read the writings of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, whose writings were only available in the original German at the time. This intense course of study certainly served to preoccupy him, but more importantly, it created new passions to replace the passions that he had lost. He showed promise of becoming a Godol when he showed signs of greatness as a teenager. When rather reacting in a normal way, as a teenager would, with anger and perhaps rebellion, a normal reaction when your life gets ripped apart, he chose to replace the lost passion with a new passion. The passion which was his mother was replaced with a total immersion in Torah, an attachment to God, and a passion for meaning and purpose in life. These broad interests were somewhat of an anathema to the Hasidic community of Hungary. His motives for studying German and other obscure subjects came under question. Hungarian shtetl surroundings. If the study of the German language wasn't enough, and his interest in these unacceptable subject matters wasn't enough, his refusal to don a strimel at his wedding was certainly cause for consternation back in Humana. Shraga Feivel was not to feel welcome in his own shtetl. Could I respectfully say that perhaps there was some sort of rebellious streak in this young man? Can we describe his refusal to conform to the parameters of what is acceptable subject matter? His refusal to conform to Hasidic dress code? Is that anything but rebellious? And I've checked with my private psychotherapist, that's my wife Dina back home, and she says, rebellion is a normal and healthy way for adolescents to express anger, or a way to search and define oneself as an adolescent. Anger, rebellion, could it be? May I utter such words? Well, to speak of my grandfather as rebellious and angry is not to have known him. I think it speaks volumes of my grandfather that he was smart enough as a teenager to properly focus his anger in passions that were constructive. How many years have I spent being angry and not doing anything constructive? The signs of a making of a gadol, if I may steal a term from this afternoon, can be seen early in life. But it was a smart answer. It was his answer to his pain. He actually changed his existence from one of physical and emotional, which was a bond he had with his mother, to an existence that was mostly spiritual, a bond with God. At the same time, he stretched himself, primarily intellectually, allowing himself to explore language, a broader range of academic interests than was common amongst his peers. He was particularly interested in works that spoke to his philosophical and existential search for a meaning in life. And his intellectual hunger went beyond what was acceptable in the shtetl. Is it any wonder now why he boarded a boat in 1913 and came to the shores of America? No one suggests this, but is it possible he was asked to leave? I'd like to take a break now to juxtapose my 90-second synopsis of his early life and how it's recorded and how I see him. I take this great man, and to the best of my ability, I try to take the facts and try to make them real. It's bizarre to suggest that God willed it that he get on a boat in 1913. There has to be some circumstances that led to it. It's bizarre to say that he was destined to establish the National Society for Hebrew Day Schools, which boasts of close to 250,000 students today, because God willed it. It's just too simple. And for me, as a grandchild, it wasn't good enough. Recently, with the publications of biographies written on him, and there are three, I began to wonder about him on a deeper and perhaps a more personal level. And I need to say that after all the books, and after all the articles, and after all the stories, I still didn't get it. I thank Elliot a little bit for pushing me to come here today, because it was the investigation of preparing for today that helped me. Sort of felt like I had a Paul Harvey type of mission. And now you know the rest of the story. I understand his life better, seeing it as a reaction to the trauma he experienced on Yom Kippur of 1896. When a young child watches in anguish as his world goes up in flames, I believe that this is what motivated him, this was the motivating force behind his life, behind his drive, and behind his accomplishments. And I will be guilty today of injecting a personal bias and a personal insight into a man's life who I only heard about and read about and did not have the privilege of knowing. And I qualify my presentation today as just that, my perspective on the complex life that was my grandfather, with my personal goal of appreciating the essence of this man. I don't know it to be the truth, but this insight helped me understand him. It answered all the questions for me. On a deeper level, it helped me connect with him. And that was a feeling that seemed to be reserved to a private club of devoted disciples. And there was no getting into this club. They knew the truth about him, but the truth they were reporting didn't resonate. So allowing myself to investigate allowed me, on a personal level, to feel like I too can be part of this club. In reviewing the biographies and in preparing this review, I taught myself what I assume any honest historian knows. There are many ways to distort history. We can simply be inaccurate about our recording. And I need to tell you, for years, the anguish that the editors went through visiting my father over and over and over again, I think 5 or 6 years before any one of the books came out, with the exception of Hillel Zeidman's book. Looking at every word as if it was a Sefer Torah and to check if it was kosher or not. And to check for the accuracy. And I believe that unlike many of the other books, such as books written about Rav Moshe Feinstein, where there are members of the Feinstein family that will tell you the books are not accurate, I haven't heard anybody claim that the book on my grandfather is in any way inaccurate. But inaccuracy is but one way of distorting history. We can also omit critical information. But here again, you must allow for editorial license. Who is to say what is critical information? Another means of revising history is by the author imposing a personal bias into his work. But here again, if I were to write a biography about my grandfather, trust me, this thing would be totally different. So what's wrong? What's wrong with the biographies? There's something very subtly wrong about the biographies. In a most subtle way, an editor can take an accurate text, and edit it to promote an agenda. Allow me to give some examples. The story goes, and it is recorded. Amazingly, it is recorded in the book, in all of the books, that in 1941, there was a dedication for a high school building of Masifta Torah Vadas. My grandfather asked the then chief rabbi of Palestine, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Herzog, to participate in the ceremonies. In his presence and in his honor, the Zionist flag was displayed. I don't know if you appreciate this. We're talking about Torah Vadas. We're talking about the Hungarian community of Williamsburg, New York. I'll help you a little bit later if you can't fill in the blanks here. That flag, the white flag with the two blue stripes with the Star of David in the center, was displayed on a march through the streets for Masifta Torah Vadas. On it, and I believe this was not a desecration of the flag because it wasn't a state symbol yet, this is 1941, on it was inscribed the words of the prophet Malachi, Zichru Toras Moshe Avdi. Remember the Torah of my servant Moshe. More amazingly, an alternative to the Hatikva was sung at the ceremony in honor of the chief rabbi. That alternative Hatikva was the Shir Emunah, a poem written by Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, the first chief rabbi of the Yishuv in Palestine. The details of this story are interesting. And for that, I suggest you buy the book at one of the local bookstores. You get it with a twist, but I don't want to go into all the details. But when you read the story, you'll scratch your head. And you'll say, Rav Cook, how did he get into this book? His name, the story, all seem so out of place and out of character for this Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich that's been depicted until page 261. The truth is, and this is not recorded, that Rav Kook, his writings, his poetry, and this Shir Emunah, this song, were all very much familiar to my grandfather. A side of my grandfather that has gone unrecorded. His love for Rav Kook, and this nobody knows, until you'll know it today, my father told this to me, his love for Rav Kook was so great that for many years he walked around in his pocket with the books of Rav Kook, one or the other, and when he had nothing else to do, that's what he would read, the works of Rav Kook. I would say his attitude, his love affair with the writings of Rav Kook were a pretty important detail when describing his life. Yet it's not there, it's not in the book. And why isn't it in the book? The answer is, it didn't fit somebody's agenda. It doesn't work for the editor. It doesn't work for the publisher. Elsewhere in the book, it speaks of different rabbis my grandfather had attempted to recruit from a Sifta Torah Vadas and had interviewed, but had not been successful in recruiting. As if it were a Chinese menu, the names listed seem all to come from the right column. But there was a left column also. In that left column was the name Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik. Yeah, the Rav. Yeah, the one from Boston. Could it be that my grandfather owned a copy of Isha Halakha? Could it be that there were notes in the margin and that he had studied it seriously? I checked the index. Rabbi Soloveitchik's name does not appear anywhere in the book. The book reports that students of Torah Vadas that were in need of a home were often invited to the Mendelowitz home in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Would it be noteworthy that one such guest was Dr. Samuel Belkin? What I would have given to listen in on their conversation. Elsewhere, it lists graduates of Torah Vadas that have gone on to be great rabbis and great movers and shakers in the Jewish educational field. Once again, I checked the index. Dr. Norman Lamb doesn't appear anywhere in the book. In 1943, my grandfather established Torah Masorah, the National Society for Hebrew Day Schools. He often referred to Torah Masorah as Mein Liebling, his project closest to his heart. The organization was first headed by Rabbi Dr. Samson Raphael Weiss, who received a doctorate in Germany, and then by Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky, a graduate of Yeshiva College. Can you imagine? He entrusted his Liebling with such individuals. Read the book and see how apologetic the author is about the credentials of these individuals. And I say, no, Rabbi Art Squirrel. You're wrong. There's no need to be apologetic. My grandfather was a great man. This was his greatness. he was able to appreciate the value of these well-educated individuals, of their professionalism, that he actually, consciously, and purposefully chose and trusted his Liebling with these professionals. So much did he value education, academia, and professionalism that if he had it his way, Torah Vadas, his institution, would have itself been handing out doctorates. I can just imagine Dr. Lyman's diploma hanging in his office, Torah Vadas University. Rabbi Huttner of Yeshiva Chaim Berlin fame appears no less than 8 times in the biography produced by Masorah Publications. According to William Helmreich research, the two, Rabbi Huttner and my grandfather, conspired, if you will, were applied and received a charter from the New York State Board of Regents to begin a university or a college. There are 8 stories about Rabbi Huttner in the book. Wouldn't you imagine that that story would be worth printing? I guess it doesn't fit someone's agenda. The book does report that he was firmly opposed to college and students attending college, despite the fact that they did. And the reason given is correct, that he believed that it was halachically not permissible to study Torah or any part of Torah or about God from people that didn't fear God. But where's the but? Why not discuss his alternative? Did his alternative also not meet the agenda? I guess I should take a moment to discuss that agenda because I talk about it. The fight for the heart and the soul of the ultra-Orthodox began back in the 40s. It was waged quietly and discreetly. It was between my grandfather's vision and that of Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Rabbi Aaron Cutler's goal was to rebuild the great yeshivot of Eastern Europe, of Lithuania and Eastern Europe. My grandfather had a totally different goal. His goal was a rainbow of sorts, of great Torah scholarship, chassidut, and modernity. And to a great extent, Rabbi Cutler has been very successful. You take a look at the community in Lakewood and its satellite communities all over the world, one of which exists just south of here. And to a great extent, my grandfather was successful. You take a look. There are many ultra-Orthodox professionals, if I may be so bold to include Rabbi Dr. Lyman in that group. And I'm sure Dr. Shapiro also, I just don't know him. But the battle for the mind and the soul of the ultra-Orthodox continues. And what better way to wage that fight than in print? Skillfully and subtly, Masorah Publications, Feldheim Publications, and the like have edited history to promote or at least give support to Rabbi Cutler's view, which today is viewed as Da'as Torah. Interestingly, I think that Rabbi Cutler's view has been totally corrupted. Today we see a blurring of the lines between the Lithuanian community, the Yeshiva Torah community, and the Hasidic community. Giants such as the Vilna Gaon and Rabbi Aaron Cutler were very clear on the differences between the two communities. Today we see the advent of a Litvish Chassid, a Lithuanian Chassid, whereas my grandfather envisioned and worked on designing a modern chassid. And just so that you don't misunderstand me, I know Dr. Lamb has recently been writing a lot about this modern Hasidism, or Hasidism as it's pronounced in the academic community. The Hasidus of my grandfather was very, very different. It wasn't an academic pursuit. My grandfather lived and breathed Hasidut. He was, in the vernacular, a Hasidish Yid. But at the very same time, he embraced modernity. He wanted to establish a university. He trusted his liebling to a yeshiva college graduate. He wanted the Rav to teach at Nesista Torah Vadas. He was completely familiar with the writings of Rav Kook. He permitted to march with the Zionist flag. He created an alternative to the Hatikva, which has its problems, and its author, with the holy words of Rav Kook. He certainly stretched that chassid in him. And I guess I struggle with my grandfather's legacy. He lived above and beyond politics. He really lived a godly existence. It's told by his students how he would break down in tears while teaching Tehillim or the book of the Navi Yeshayahu, often unable to finish the lecture. How he would spend Tisha B'Av sitting on the floor, sobbing. At Ben Gurion Airport last night, someone must have mentioned to someone else who I was, and this man runs over to me, and he tells me, says, "I must tell you, I grew up in East New York, which is a section of Brooklyn, New York, in the 1940s, it must have been. It must have been around that time, although that's not so accurate because, well, it could have been 40, 41, or 42. So yeah, maybe it is accurate. And he says, and we got invited to your grandfather's Seder on Pesach night. And we walked all the way from East New York, Brooklyn, to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, to attend the Seder. And he says it was unbelievable. The puddles of tears, I'm sure that's an exaggeration, it was probably a wet handkerchief, but the puddles of tears that came from your grandfather's eyes as he recited Nishma, which reminds me of a story we all know recorded from Rav Shlomo. Rav Shlomo says how, Shlomo Kalbach, how he says, you know, people say Nishmas, you're going to shul, and people saying Nishmas, and the words are going down. And we say Nishmas, the words have to go up. In our shul, on Moshav Yishi, we sing Nishmas every Shabbos morning. It's like the highlight of the Shabbos morning service. The pain of the Jewish people was his pain. The yearning for the rebuilding of Jerusalem was the pain he lived with constantly. And the rebuilding of the Jewish homeland was his wish. How well we can understand, as a 10-year-old boy, he lost his home. My wife always tells me, and I unfortunately used to do many funerals as a Rav in Hicksville. I had an elderly congregation. And it was always very hard to do funerals. I look back at it as the most important thing, and actually the only thing that remains with me from the years in Rabbanus in America are those funerals. That's what remains with me. But it was always very hard. My wife used to say, "You're not crying about Moshe, whose funeral is doing. There's something inside of you that you're crying about, a loss of yours, because we always are crying for something inside of us because we don't really feel the next person's pain on such a level." And so I struggle for my grandfather's legacy. I struggle with my grandfather's legacy. as evidenced by my kippah sugah, you can see that I am what they call the white sheep of my family. I know that my grandfather was great enough, he was complex enough, to embrace all halachically sound alternatives in Yiddishkeit, including and specifically and especially religious Zionism. His stance against Mizrahi and the Mizrahi movement was not so much ideological as it was social. And in the books, there's a total distortion of the problems he had with Mizrahi. And just take a look at his love affair with the writings of Rav Kook. He encouraged the establishment of a student group in Torah Vedas called Yesod HaMa'aleh. It was a group of students dedicated to the goal of living in Eretz Yisrael. The religious Zionism of Hebron, of Kiryat Arba, of Rabbi Levinger, the religious Zionism of Merkaz HaRav, of Rav Shapiro, the religious Zionism today of Machon HaMikdash, is a religious Zionism that I know my grandfather would embrace. And I would go further to say that if he was alive today, he'd be at the forefront of these organizations. As a grandchild, I grew up living in his shadow. As a child, resenting it. As an angry teenager. Finally, growing up, appreciating an opportunity. Along with the rest of my family, we all believe we are the embodiment of his dream. And that may be true, but only I can claim to be living proof of his complexity. Yet, reading the biographies would not lead you to believe that he was all that complex. And that's because, in a most subtle way, the editors of his biographies very skillfully wanted to promote an agenda. This agenda of Das Torah, this agenda of Rav Aaron Kotler, the alternative agenda. Does all this mean you shouldn't read the book? The books are inaccurate? No. Yet, unlike the authors and the editors, I will not ignore any facts about my grandfather to better understand his life. That an accurate text was edited to promote an agenda is a halbasar. But more importantly, the editors robbed him of his complexity and thereby robbed the man of much of his greatness. And don't get me wrong, the biographies do a wonderful job to paint the picture of who this man was. For tens of thousands of students that graduated the yeshiva system and the Hebrew day school system, they should find it interesting to find out who was the architect of these systems. And in truth, I'm feeling a little bit overly critical of persons who had good intentions today. He had many, many great accomplishments, and the books should be read. My grandfather died at a relatively young age of 62 in 1948. In 1948, at the next critical juncture of Jewish history, nobody knows for sure where he would stand on today's issues. But I would like to believe that had he lived longer, he would have retired to Israel and created a similar revolution, a bridge between the world of Torah, the world of Hasidism, and the world of modernity. Family legend has it that during the War of Independence, when word came of the loss of the old city in the hands of the enemy, while reciting the third bracha of the Birkat HaMazon, Rachim Na Hashem Elokeinu HaYisrael Amecha, V'al Yerushalayim Yirecha V'al Tzion Mishkan Kvodecha, we ask God for mercy on Jerusalem and on Zion. While reciting this, my grandfather suffered a massive heart attack. So much was his love for Jerusalem. So much did he live with the pain of the Jewish people. One last interesting note. He passed away on Gimel Elul, the third day of Elul. He shares a yahrzeit with Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, a man with whom I believe he felt a kindred spirit. On a personal note, I invite you all to join me in Israel, where we can together continue my grandfather's legacy, merging the three great worlds, the world of Torah, the world of the hidden, the world of Chassidut, and the world of modernity. Together may we merit a complete Jewish existence, achieve closeness with the Almighty. May our lives be a sanctification of God's name, and may we merit to witness in the cities of Jerusalem, in the cities of Judah, and the streets of Jerusalem, kol sason v'kol simcha, the sounds of joy and the sounds of happiness. And in the words of Rav Kook in the Shir Emunah, la'ad chaya bilvavenu, Yehuda ha'ne'emana, lashuv le'eretz kadshenu. Thank you for the opportunity.
If you'll notice on the flyers, this day of learning is sponsored in part in memory of my grandfather, who his ninth yahrzeit is on the first day of Hanukkah. So I want to call on my uncle, Avram Friedman, just to say a couple words on my grandfather. So I want to thank our family for bringing you this the great day of learning. We'll have lunch and continue with the in the afternoon.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. It really is a tremendous chus for me to be here on behalf of the sponsors for today's shiurim. My mother, Mrs. Yetta Friedman, my brother-in-law, Rabbi Joseph Kelman, my sister, Sheila Train, who's in Houston, couldn't be with us here today. And as I'm sitting listening to the wonderful words of Torah, I can't help thinking about Moshe Emes, the Toroso Emes, and that as I think back to my father, who came to this country in the 20s, he came from Galicia, a small town near Lemberg, and I suppose he was a chacham who was Roas HaNolad in the 20s. He had been in the Polish army, and he related to me the story of his being wearing his tefillin one day, and one of the officers threw the tefillin, his shal rosh, off of his face, and he immediately responded with punching him in the face, and he was then put in prison for a few days. And I guess it was at that point that he determined that there was no future for him. So he left his entire family behind. He had a sister who came to Canada a few years earlier, and she assisted him in coming to Toronto. He didn't have the good fortune of learning in yeshivas, but he had the tefillin of his grandfather when he came to Toronto, and he had the Lev Tov. And I was his only son, and he was determined that I was going to be the beneficiary of a yeshiva education. In the 50s, there was not yet yeshiva Sneir Yisrael in Toronto. He was miyayetz with Rav Felder, whose two boys were attending Sneir Yisrael in Baltimore. At that time, Rav Yaakov Weinberg was the Rosh Mechina, so I had the honor of learning from him, as well as practicing violin in his son's bedroom every night. You see, my parents were determined that although I was going to go to the yeshiva, I still needed to continue with my violin studies. So they drove me to the yeshiva. They met with Rav Weinberg, and they said, I'll give you our son if you can arrange for him to continue with his violin studies. Rav Weinberg found a violin teacher and offered me Matthias Weinberg's room. Every night Matthias was learning in Telz. I was upstairs after Mara practicing the violin and had the privilege of having warm milk with Rebbetzin Weinberg every evening. At any rate, my father also was very careful to select the right shidduch for his daughter. Our uncle, Rav Yossel Osalka, those of you from Toronto will remember Rav Yossel Osalki, who at the time was very, very close with Harav Price, discussed the possibilities of shidduchim, Rav Yossel Osalka looking after his niece, my sister, and Rav Price looking after his talmidim, Rav Kelman. Rav Kelman's father, of course, came to Toronto to become one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Eitz Chaim and was the Rav of many shuls in Toronto when, unfortunately, he died at the very young age of 40. But it's so wonderful to see the Yad Hashem and the Shalshalas. So here we are today benefiting from, I guess, my father's forethought, Rabbi Kelman's forethought and his father coming to this city, and the wonderful work that Rav J. Kelman, who's named after his grandfather, Rav Yehuda Leib Kelman, is doing, of which we are all truly benefiting. May you continue to do this wonderful book of being Marbitz Torah in our community and elsewhere. Thank you very much for coming.